Then the Buddha said to the Crown Prince Manjushri, Manjushri, go to the Lichavi Vimalakirti to inquire about his illness. Manjushri replied, Lord, it is difficult to attend upon the Lichavi Vimalakirti. He is gifted with marvellous eloquence concerning the profound principle. He is extremely skilled in full expressions and in the reconciliation of dichotomies. His eloquence is invincible, and no one can resist his imperturbable intellect. He accomplishes all the activities of the bodhisattvas. He penetrates all the secret mysteries of the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. He is skilled in civilizing all the abodes of the Maras. He plays with the great super knowledges. He is consummate in wisdom and skillful means. He has attained the supreme perfection of the indivisible non-dual Dharma Dhatu. He is skilled in teaching the Dharma with its infinite modalities within the unique harmony of the Dharma Dhatu. He is skilled in granting means of attainment in accordance with the spiritual faculties of all living beings. He has thoroughly integrated his wisdom with skillful means. He has attained decisiveness with regard to all questions. Thus, although he cannot be withstood by someone of my feeble defences, still, sustained by the Adishtana of the Buddha, I will go to him and I will converse with him as well as I can. Thereupon, in that assembly, the bodhisattvas, the great disciples, the chakras, the brahmas, the lokapalas and the gods and goddesses all had this thought, surely the conversation of the Crown Prince Manjushri and that good man will result in a profound teaching of the Dharma. Thus, 8,000 bodhisattvas, 500 disciples, a great number of chakras, brahmas, lokapalas, and many hundreds of thousands of gods and goddesses all followed the Crown Prince Manjushri to listen to the Dharma. And the Crown Prince Manjushri, surrounded and followed by these bodhisattvas, disciples, chakras, brahmas, lokapalas, gods and goddesses, entered the great city of Vaishali. At that moment, the Lichavi Vimalakirti thought to himself, Manjushri the Crown Prince is coming here with an immense following to inquire about my illness. I shall, with magic power, transform this house into emptiness. Then, magically, his house became empty. Even the doorkeeper disappeared. And except for the invalid's couch, upon which Vimalakirti himself was lying, no bed or couch or seat could be seen anywhere. Then the Lichavi Vimalakirti saw the Crown Prince Manjushri and addressed him thus, Manjushri, welcome, Manjushri. You are very welcome. There you are, without any coming. You appear without any seeing. You are heard without any hearing. Manjushri declared, Householder, it is as you say. Who comes, finally comes not. Who goes, finally goes not. Why? Who comes is not known to come. Who goes is not known to go. Who appears is finally not to be seen. Good sir, is your condition tolerable? Is it bearable? Are your physical elements disturbed? Are your painful symptoms diminishing and not increasing? The Buddha asks about you. If you have slight trouble, slight discomfort, slight sickness, if your distress is light, if you are cared for, strong, at ease, without self-reproach, and if you are living in touch with the supreme happiness. Householder, whence came this sickness of yours? How long will it last? What is it based on? How can it be alleviated? Vimalakirti replied, Manjushri, my sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it will last as long as the sicknesses of all living beings. Were all living beings to be free from sickness, I also would not be sick. Why? Manjushri, for the Bodhisattva, the world consists only of living beings, and sickness is inherent in living in the world. Were all living beings free of sickness, the Bodhisattva also would be free of sickness. For example, Manjushri, when the only son of a merchant is sick, both his parents become sick on account of the sickness of their son. And the parents will suffer as long as that only son does not recover from his sickness. Just so, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva loves all living beings as if each were his only child. He becomes sick when they are sick and is cured when they are cured. You ask me, Manjushri, whence comes my sickness? The sicknesses of the Bodhisattvas arise from great compassion. So here we have the first appearance of Manjushri, the gentle radiance, the Bodhisattva of transcendental wisdom, the crown prince, the Kumara Buddha, the ever youthful Manjushri, Manjugosha, the sweet voiced Manjunata, the gentle protector. In many ways, Manjushri, Manjugosha is the Bodhisattva. Might sound a strange way of talking, but in Indian Buddhism, especially Manjugosha, Manjushri, is probably the most important, the most central of all the Bodhisattvas. Might sound a bit of a surprise because you're probably very aware of Avalokiteshvara and so on. But really, Manjushri, Manjugosha is the sort of the great archetypal Bodhisattva. Interestingly, he's the sort of patron Bodhisattva of Buddhist monasteries, I think, because of his association with learning. And he only feels able to go to see Vimalakirti. Even he is rather daunted by it, and he can only go with the Adhisthana of the Buddha. And much of the rest of the sutra is really dialogues between Manjugosha, Manjushri, and Vimalakirti. And as you saw from that reading, everybody wants to be there, or a lot of people want to be there, because they know that it's going to be a real ding-dong Dharma discussion, a very profound discussion. And you've got a bit of an indication of that right at the beginning with Vimalakirti's challenge to Manjushri, who is actually equal to the task. But the first thing that Manjushri does after the playful shunyata duel at the beginning, he wants to know about Vimalakirti's sickness. And of course, it's a very profound, a very moving reply that Vimalakirti gives. The sicknesses of the Bodhisattva arise from great compassion. And there's this evocation of the care of the Bodhisattva for all living beings. The Bodhisattva is likened to the parents living beings are likened to the only son of very wealthy merchants, a very wealthy merchant family. There's a very strong Indian context, of course, going on here, because the whole idea of the son, he's going to take the dynasty on into the future. So the parents are very, very deeply concerned for the welfare of their son, and if the son gets sick, they feel sick, they feel worried, they feel troubled. And of course, this recalls very strongly the Karaniya Metta Sutta, doesn't it, where the Buddha says that the love that we need to develop for all living beings is like the love of a mother to her only child. It's that close, completely inseparable, that intensely protective and maturing love felt for all beings, all living beings whatsoever, not exclusive. And of course, the protection and maturing is not just sort of to do with the sort of instincts that can go on with parenthood. It's to do with the maturing and the protecting and the bringing people on in the Dharma to liberation. That's what a Bodhisattva's love really is. This is what we're being called to develop in this sutra. This is what we're being called to develop in the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This quality of loving. This quality of loving for all living beings. As Sangharakshita said in his commentary on the Karaniya Metta Sutta, it doesn't mean going around mothering everybody. That would be very, very off-putting, wouldn't it? You know, what it's like to be mothered. It's not entirely pleasant, is it? If we're not in the mood. It's about developing this maturing metta, this love that brings about the maturation, the development of living beings in the Dharma. That's the kind of love that is being mentioned here. And you're that connected, you're that close, you know, through that love. This is what we're being called to do. But without any sentimentality, without any pity. This is another big theme in the Vimalakirti Nidesha that we'll see a bit later. No sentimentality, no pity, but just a very, very clear love and compassion, really concerned with the deep potential of all living beings. This is the great challenge that particularly the Mahayana issue to us, the Bodhisattva path, but it's there also in the Pali texts, in the earliest texts. We're that deeply connected with all life. And the overriding concern is for the maturing of others in the Dharma. I find this, and I think we have to be really humble in relation to this vision, in relation to this ideal. It's really unimaginable, I think. Seems to me unimaginable. I can try to imagine it. But to have that quality of loving attention, and also that quality of wisdom, because with that quality of loving attention that brings people on in the Dharma requires great wisdom, to have that quality towards each and every living being, well, let's not pretend that you know, we have that. Let's ponder it in reverence and humility, that ideal. You see glimpses of it. A very lovely text to read is Dada Rinpoche's celebration. I'm reading the accounts of particularly Dada Rinpoche's Tibetan disciples and the way Rinpoche was in relation to them. This incredible quality of loving attention to everybody. And also he was a man of great wisdom and learning and could on occasion be quite fierce. His secretary told me how fierce Rinpoche could be with them if they weren't doing what they should be doing in the school for the benefit of others. But it's that kind of quality that we're being called to practice, to be transformed by. And the conversation continues between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. Manjushri at a certain point wants to know how a bodhisattva should console a bodhisattva who is sick. Again, there is great antecedents in this, in the tradition. You notice the questions that Manjushri was asking Vimalakirti about his sickness, and he wants to know, for example, are you feeling any self-reproach? This is a sort of traditional question, because, you know, if you're sick, especially if it's fairly serious, well, if you're feeling self-reproach, you know, you feel you haven't been living up to your ideals, well, that can be quite a difficult time if you're sick, if you have regret. So it's an important question. Are you, you know, is there anything you need to blame yourself for? You know, sickness, especially if it's something serious, is a time to really take stock of your life and how you're living your life. And yes, in the tradition, the sick person, you know, will be, you know, when the teacher comes, when the bodhisattva comes, when the bhikkhu comes, when the Kalyana Mitra comes, even when the Buddha comes, there'll be, it won't just be, well, you know, be comfortable, have a rest and all that sort of thing. Of course, that's there. But there'll be teaching, instruction. How do you work with this? How do you practice while you're sick? So Vimalakirti tells Manjushri how a bodhisattva should console a sick bodhisattva. Vimalakirti says he should tell him that the body is impermanent, but should not exhort him to disgust with the world and dispassion. He should tell him that the body is painful, but should not encourage him to delight in a selfish nirvana. He should tell him that the body is without self, but that he should ripen living beings and not to seek the ultimate calm. He should encourage him to use his own sickness to have compassion for all living beings, so as to drive away their sickness. He encourages him to recall the suffering experienced from beginningless time in order to work for the welfare of living beings. He encourages him to make the great vow to always strive to become the King of Healers who can cure all sickness. Thus should a bodhisattva console a sick bodhisattva in such a way as to make him happy. And the conversation continues for a number of pages. But the teaching throughout is very clear. When we're sick, when we're ill, when we're in pain, we use that to develop both wisdom and compassion. Sometimes when we're sick, when we're ill, when we're in pain, we use that as time off from practice. Sometimes that happens, so I'll just stop thinking about all that. But the tradition says no. This is a time to engage, in a sense, even more intensively with practice. You might not be able to sit up and meditate. You might not be able to, you know, do intensive study. You might not in that time be able to work for the Dharma, but you can reflect. You can reflect deeply. In some ways, it's a really good time for reflection because you can't do very much else. So we use the time of sickness to develop both wisdom and compassion. And later, Vimalakirti gives very intensive wisdom contemplations. He talks about sickness. We need to recognize that sickness arises from ignorance. We are sick because we are embodied. We're embodied because of ignorance and the karma formations. In a general sense, that is, we have a body. Well, we get, and having a body means we get sick. That's unavoidable. Where does that come from? Where does that embodiment come from? It comes ultimately from ignorance, something deeply profound in that kind of contemplation. But probably much more importantly for us, for most of us, we need to use sickness and illness and pain to identify with others, with all others. Because in a sense, everybody is sick, whether actually or potentially. Everybody is sick. Even if they're not physically sick, they have the sicknesses of the kleshas. They have the sickness of greed, hatred and delusion. Sickness is not personal. It's not just, you know, we haven't got a monopoly on sickness. Sickness is all pervading. And I think this is, you know, really important. I've already mentioned that a few years ago I had the biggest illness I've had in my life with appendicitis, which wasn't diagnosed for some time, so I was getting iller and iller and iller. And then, you know, it was dealt with. But it was a difficult time for me in many ways. And one of the things I realised was in that state of sickness, I felt terribly alone. Even though I was actually helped enormously by my friends in the community, and people were extremely kind and attentive and so on. But in another sense, I felt terribly alone. And I'm sure, you know, I know some people here are, you know, suffering from sicknesses of one kind or another. And you can feel very isolated and alone in that place, existentially alone. And I read the passages on sickness in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. I read and reread these passages. And I found them immensely helpful. Immensely helpful to, you know, sort of get find a way of practicing in relation to this aloneness and this, or even loneliness, and in relation to this illness and, you know, all the fears and anxieties that were going with that. And what I found particularly helpful was not fixating on my own sickness, not fixating on my own illness. And of course, you know, comparatively, my illness from a certain point of view was quite minor. I know some people are facing very serious illness. Mine was really, in the general scheme of things, fairly small beer. But even so, I felt this aloneness, but I used it to reflect, well, just like Vimalakirti says, recognising the sickness of all beings, whether actually or potentially. If you're embodied, you get ill, you get old, you die. And continually, as soon as I was sort of retreating into myself, I expanded. I brought to mind other people, people who are actually sick. And of course, I have many friends and relations and loved ones who I know who are sick. But just widening that to everybody. It's not just the actually sick. Everybody has this in potential. And as I say, everybody has the kleshas. We're all unenlightened. So in a sense, we're all sick. And this is the basis, of course, of this quite well-known meditation that developed particularly in Tibetan Buddhism out of Indian origins, the Tonglen meditation, the sending and receiving meditation. Might have read about this, where you there's different ways you can do it, accompanied by visualization. But the main point of the practice is when you notice sickness, pain, even a sort of negative mental state or whatever it might be, you immediately identify with all others. You even reflect, may I take on the sickness of all beings, and may all beings be relieved from that sickness. If you're in a negative state, a state of craving or fear or hatred, may I take on the fear, the hatred, or whatever it might be in all beings, and may they all be free of that. You can even, use a visualization to accompany that. You know, as you reflect on the suffering, the pain in all beings, you see that as sort of black smoke that you breathe in, but which transforms in your heart into light, and you breathe out white light on all living beings and imagine them becoming liberated from all their suffering. Sounds like a very challenging practice, but it's actually an extremely positive, big-hearted, generous, liberating practice. And you can do it with your positive states as well. So if you're in a state of joy, of happiness, you've done a good thing through your practice, you reflect, may all beings have this joy. May all beings have this quality. And may I take in, all their suffering. And may they all have this quality. So really, really big-hearted practice. Obviously, you need to prepare for it with lots of metta, lots of devotion, lots of understanding. But the whole point is that you're liberating yourself from that separation. You're liberating yourself from that isolation that you can feel, especially when you're feeling sick, either physically or mentally, and you start to relax, you start to open up much, much more fully to the world around you. It's a very, very powerful, important practice. And, you can carry it on all the time. You can do this practice quite intensively, and it can really accompany your metta bhavana practice. So, yes, Vimalakirti shows us through this how a bodhisattva consoles a sick bodhisattva. He uses it to identify with others. He uses it to see things more and more deeply. And the conversation between Vimalakirti and Manjushri goes deeper and deeper. And it emerges into Vimalakirti talking about the indivisibility of wisdom and compassionate skillful means. He's very concerned for the bodhisattva to avoid one-sidedness. One-sidedness in Dharma life. If you just develop compassion without wisdom, compassionate skillful means, you will go wrong. You'll get exhausted. If you just develop wisdom, you will become indifferent. Let me just read what he says. There's going to be a fair few readings today, which is appropriate given it's the last talk. The sick bodhisattva should tell himself, Just as my sickness is unreal and non-existent, so the sicknesses of all living beings are unreal and non-existent. Through such understanding, he avoids a mind invaded by sentimentally motivated views and produces the great compassion for beings that strives to eliminate any adventitious passions in beings. Why? Because great compassion that falls into sentimentally motivated views only exhausts the bodhisattva in his rebirths. But the great compassion, which is free of involvement with sentimentally motivated views, does not exhaust the bodhisattva in all his rebirths. He is not reborn through involvement with such views, but is reborn with his mind free of involvement. Hence, even his rebirth is like liberation. Incredible statement. Even his rebirth is like liberation. Being reborn as if being liberated, he has the power and ability to teach the Dharma which liberates living beings from their bondage. It is with a hidden intention that the Buddha declared, it is impossible, it cannot occur, that someone who is himself bound can liberate others from their bondage, but it is possible that someone who is himself liberated can liberate others from their bondage. That is why a bodhisattva should seek liberation and cut through bondage. For a bodhisattva, what is bondage and what is liberation? For a bodhisattva to be free of existence while excluding skillful means, this is bondage. On the contrary, to enter into the world of existence with the aid of skillful means, this is liberation. For a bodhisattva to taste the flavour of the dhyanas, the liberations, the samadhis, and the meditative attainments in the absence of skillful means is bondage. On the contrary, to taste the flavour of the dhyanas and the samadhis while having recourse to skillful means is liberation. Wisdom not attained with skillful means is bondage. On the contrary, wisdom attained with skillful means is liberation. Skillful means not attained with wisdom is bondage. On the contrary, skillful means attained with wisdom is liberation. I mean, this really, of course, is way beyond us, actually. We're nowhere near this kind of contemplation, the kind of contemplation where, you know, there's going to be a conflict between wisdom and greatly compassionate, skillful means. You know, we're definitely not there. But at least I think it's making it clear to us what a bodhisattva might be. We have to do some real imagining here. What would it really be like to be in the world, really connecting with people where they are, and yet not being defined by them in any way, coming from profound wisdom, and yet a wisdom that doesn't lead to a sort of coolness and indifference? This is what we're being asked to develop. This is what we're being asked to work to. And it's a theme that the Mahayana tirelessly proclaim in all the different teachings. It's a wonderful verse from a Mahayana sutra shastra called the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, the dual lineage shastra. And it's one of Sangharakshita's favourite Dharma verses, and it's a description of a bodhisattva. And it goes something like a fire. He constantly blazes up into works for others, yet he always remains in the calm of the meditative absorptions and formless attainments. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're aiming for in our practice. That's what we're aspiring to. Perhaps there are equivalents to it on our own level. Perhaps there are times in which we get one-sided. We get overly concerned with our personal development, so that we become rather precious and disconnected from people. That's a blind alley. Sometimes we can get so sort of frenetic and over-involved in trying to help others in some way that we lose connection with any depth, any wisdom, any understanding. We need to work with these tensions on higher and higher levels in our Dharma life. And I think this is where the spiritual community and spiritual friendship is particularly helpful if it's a true spiritual community that we're involved with. This will be a constant sort of area of exploration and understanding. You know, our spiritual friends saying to us, hey, you need to get on retreat. You need to go and do a lot more meditation. You know, you're rushing around trying to put out all these fires, but this is just a kind of ego trip, really. Or somebody's so into their special practices and meditations and insights, they become so sort of precious, they can't even make a cup of tea for other people. They can't do anything for other people. You know, and there's a strange sort of conceit with that. Well, that's when spiritual friends say, come on, come and do some gardening. Come and do some washing up. Come and look after that person who is sick. Stop disappearing up your own proverbia. But really, this union of wisdom and skillful means is way, way out there. Way beyond. The Vimalakirti Nidesha is way beyond. In a sense, we shouldn't even be talking about it. I shouldn't be talking about it, but it's just so fantastic. We can't resist. I can't resist. As Sangharakshita said in that that letter that Aryabhandhu read out at the very beginning, you know, when you read that sutra, and in those lectures that Sangharakshita gave, you know, for a while, entering into that transcendental plane, that realm of the inconceivable. So this leads us to the inconceivable emancipation, which is the title of the next chapter, the inconceivable liberation, the Achintya Vimoksha, which is an alternative name for the Vimalakirti Nidesha. And this next chapter begins with Shariputra, poor old Shariputra, and remember it's not the Sariputta of the Pali Canon. This is a symbol of something, but poor old Shariputra is a bit the fool guy really in this sutra. There's a lot of people at Vimalakirti's house. It's a bit curious, this detail, because although the house has disappeared into emptiness, somehow or other, they're all actually in a house. I don't know, I can't work that out. But anyway, never mind. It begins with, maybe it came back after a while. Anyway, it begins with Shariputra worrying about where everybody's going to sit. He's looking around, and he's genuine concern, thinking, well, where are all these bodhisattvas and arahants and, you know, all these dignitaries, where are they going to sit? You know, there's a lot of us here in this house. You know, thousands of them. Vimalakirti, of course, can read Shariputra's mind. He can pick up the vibes going on in Shariputra, and he says, Reverend Shariputra, did you come here for the sake of the Dharma, or did you come here for the sake of a chair? And of course we've got our own versions of that particular concern. Shariputra quickly comes back and says, I've come here for the sake of the Dharma and not a chair. And Vimalakirti then launches into this incredible discourse on what it means to be interested in the Dharma. First thing he says, he who is interested in the Dharma is not even interested in his own body and mind and its functions, much less in a chair. And he goes on and on and on like this, you know, really, you basically sort of saying someone really interested in the Dharma, really interested in the truth, really interested in reality, is not interested in anything. He's not being nihilistic. You know, he's just saying there is this incredible focus on reality. You need to cast everything aside. A great, you know, Vimalakirti Nidesha is full of these amazing vajra strikes, which, you know, we need to apply to ourselves. You know, very often we want the Dharma on our own terms, don't we? You know, we want the Dharma. You know, we're interested in the Dharma, just providing we can incorporate it into everything else. You know, a bit of Buddhism, make us feel a bit better. But it's really not like that. You know, if you're serious about the Dharma, you have to really put yourself out. You really have to put yourself out. I remember years ago, there was this big concern about the ordination training. You know, and that, well, you know, there's so many different types of people. We need to develop a bespoke ordination training for every single individual. You know, it's totally tuned up so that don't feel off balance in their ordination training. I mean, ridiculous idea. It's one of those things committees think up. I wasn't involved. And then I thought, well, how? Since when has a Buddhist training in the tradition, wherever you look, since when have people ever felt comfortable? Did Milarepa feel comfortable with Marpa? I don't think so. Did Marpa feel comfortable with Naropa? I don't think so. You know, if you're off balance, that's a very good sign. That's actually a sign that you're sort of getting somewhere, that if it's not on your terms, that's a really good thing. That's the way it should be. That's what life is like. You can't even have life on your own terms. So if you're feeling kind of off balance at times in your ordination training, well, use that to reflect. Use that to reflect on the Dharma. Use that to reflect on the whole issue of ownership, of trying to mould life according to your own desires. It's very, very good, very important at times to be in situations where it really isn't on your terms, where you don't like the food, where you don't like the accommodation, where you even don't like the people. You know, I mean, that's a real shocker, you know, when you're in the spiritual community sometimes. I've been in chapters sometimes, and there I am with people, and I think, I really don't want to be with you. You know, if I'd had my life another way, you're not the kind of person that I'd want to be with. But they're going for refuge. I know that. They're totally devoted to the Dharma. So what am I going to say? I don't want to be with you because I don't like you. You should leave the order. And I'm not going to leave the order, am I? So you've got to work. You've got to work with that person and see much more deeply what the Dharma is. So yes, we can't have the Dharma on our own terms. We've got to kind of really work with the circumstances and conditions that are presented to us. But Vimalakirti, having done this, he is actually concerned about the seating arrangements in his house. And he turns to Manjushri and says, Manjushri, you've travelled extensively throughout all the Buddha lands, all the Buddha fields, in the vast trikiliocosm, galaxy, billion, world, whatever. Where are the best lion thrones in all your journeys? Where are the best, most splendid, most beautiful lion thrones? So Manjushri says something like, if I can get this right, if you travel to the east, as many leagues as there are grains of sand in 32 Ganges rivers, a long way away, you find a Buddha field called Meru Pradipa, called Merudvaja, the banner of Meru. And there is a Buddha named Meru Pradipa Raja. His body is 8,400,000 leagues high, and his throne is 600,000 times leagues high. The bodhisattvas in this pure land, in this Buddha field, are 4,200,000 leagues tall, and their lion thrones are 3,400,000 leagues high. I think that's it. Check out the sutra. I mean, where they get these numbers from, I don't know. And then Manjushri, they're the best. They're the best lion thrones in the entire cosmic system. So Vimalakirti says, okay. And he draws all these massive, splendid lion thrones down, thousands and thousands of them for this assembly that have gathered in his house in the great city of Vaishali, enough for everybody to be, you know, to take their seat. And the amazing thing is, they don't crowd the house, and the house doesn't expand. And the great city of Vaishali isn't obscured either. Amazing, isn't it? That's going to blow your minds. You do wonder what they were taking, these Mahayana guys. It's meditation, I think. So yes, the lion thrones are all there. Massive lion thrones, but the house doesn't expand. There's no crowding. And the great city of Vaishali is not obscured. And everybody is amazed. How is this happening? And at this point, Shariputra asks a question. He is so amazed. After everybody's taken their seats, and there's a whole story about how people take their seats, but I won't go into that. So they're all on these thrones, you know, on these massive thrones, all looking at one another, with Vimalakirti in the middle. Presumably he's still on his couch. Then the venerable Shariputra said to the Lichavi Vimalakirti, "Noble sir, it is astonishing that these thousands of thrones, so big and so high, should fit into such a small house, and that the great city of Vaishali, the villages, cities, kingdoms, capitals of Jambudvipa, the other three continents, the abodes of the gods, the Nagas, the Yakshas, the Gandharvas, the Asuras, the Garudas, the Kingnaras, and the Maharagas, that all of these should appear without any obstacle, just as they were before." I mean, they're that vast, they could obscure the whole cosmos, but they don't. The Lichavi Vimalakirti replied, "Venerable Shariputra, for the Tathagatas and the Bodhisattvas, there is a liberation called inconceivable. The Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation can put the king of mountains, Sumeru, which is so high, so great, so noble and so vast, into a mustard seed. He can perform this feat without enlarging the mustard seed and without shrinking Mount Sumeru. And the deities of the assembly of the four Maharajas and of the Triastrinks of heavens who live on Meru do not even know where they are. Only those beings who are destined to be disciplined by miracles see and understand the putting of the king of mountains, Sumeru, into the mustard seed. That, Venerable Shariputra, is an entrance to the domain of the inconceivable liberation of the Bodhisattvas. Furthermore, Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation can pour into a single pore of his skin all the waters of the four great oceans without injuring the water animals such as fish, tortoises, crocodiles, frogs and other creatures. And without the Nagas, Yakshas, Gandharvas and Asuras even being aware of where they are. And the whole operation is visible without any injury or disturbance to any of those living beings. Such a Bodhisattva can pick up with his right hand this billion world galactic universe as if it was a potter's wheel and spinning it round, throw it beyond universes as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, without the living beings therein knowing their motion or its origin, and he can catch it and put it back in its place without the living beings suspecting their coming and going, and yet the whole operation is visible. Furthermore, Venerable Shariputra, there are beings who become disciplined after an immense period of evolution, and there are also those who are disciplined after a short period of evolution. The Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation, for the sake of disciplining those living beings who are disciplined through immeasurable periods of evolution, can make the passing of a week seem like the passing of an eon. Can seem like that on retreats, can't it? And he can make the passing of an eon seem like the passing of a week for those who are disciplined through a short period of evolution. Can seem like that on a retreat too. The living beings who are disciplined through an immeasurable period of evolution actually perceive a week to be the passing of an eon, and those disciplined by a short period of evolution actually perceive an eon to be the passing of a week. Thus, a Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation can manifest all the splendours of the virtues of all the Buddha fields within a single Buddha field. Likewise, he can place all living beings in the palm of his right hand and can show them with the supernatural speed of thought all the Buddha fields without ever leaving his own Buddha field. He can display in a single pore all the offerings ever offered to all the Buddhas of the ten directions and the orbs of all the suns, moons and stars of the ten directions. He can inhale all the hurricanes of the cosmic wind atmospheres of the ten directions into his mouth without harming his own body and without letting the forests and grasses of the Buddha fields be flattened. He can take all the masses of fire, of all the supernovas that ultimately consume all the universes, of all the Bitterfields into his stomach without interfering with their functions, having crossed Bitterfields numerous as the sands of the Ganges downward. And having taken up a Bitterfield, he can rise up through Bitterfields as numerous as the sands of the Ganges and place it on high, just as a strong man may pick up a jujube leaf on the point of a needle. Thus, a bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation can magically transform any kind of living being into a universal monarch, a lokapala, a chakra, a brahma, a disciple, a solitary sage, a bodhisattva, and even into a Buddha. The bodhisattva can transform miraculously all the cries and noises, superior, mediocre, and inferior, of all living beings of the 10 directions into the voice of the Buddha, with the words of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, having them proclaim impermanent, unsatisfactory, empty, selfless, and he can cause them to recite the words and sounds of all the teachings taught by all the Buddhas of the 10 directions. Venerable Shariputra, I have shown you only a small part of the entrance into the domain of the Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation. Venerable Shariputra, to explain to you the teaching of the full entrance into the domain of the Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation would require more than an eon, and even more than that. Wow. Mahā Kaśyapa, who's one of the disciples in the assembly, is just amazed at this discourse. I think if we were there, we'd be pretty amazed and stunned too, to have somebody saying that and actually meaning it. Saying it as the truth, as the way things are for a bodhisattva. It's pretty amazing just to read it from the text. And Mahā Kaśyapa says to Shariputra that those concerned simply with their own one-sided emancipation, their own selfish pursuit of the Dharma, they could not possibly comprehend the inconceivable liberation of the Bodhisattva. And he says, on hearing this teaching, those of us who are like that should utter a great cry of regret that would shake this billion world galactic system. A great cry, in other words, a great sort of existential cry of regret and longing, because we feel barred from that vision, barred from that attainment. Whereas, Mahā Kaśyapa says, the bodhisattvas, those who practice the Dharma, not for themselves alone, but for the benefit of all, for all beings, when they are presented with this great vision, they are joyful, supremely joyful, just as a young crown prince, when he is anointed by the king, takes their crown, they feel increased devotion and love for this inconceivable liberation. So I think we need to identify with Mahā Kaśyapa in relation to the inconceivable liberation that's been evoked in this sutra. He's just completely amazed by it, but feels it's beyond his comprehension and attainment. But when he talks about uttering that great cry that would fill the entire galactic universe, like I say, I think that's kind of like a cry of longing for that kind of, you know, for some kind of understanding, some kind of entry into that vision. So I'm not going to try and explain to you what the inconceivable liberation is. I felt it was important to include it in the presentation because it's so central to the sutra. Perhaps we just need to contemplate the inconceivable liberation, be inspired by it, and wonder at, you know, what it could possibly mean. Does it mean anything? Just one little note. I find it very interesting that the inconceivable liberation, the chapter on the inconceivable liberation, comes after the chapter on sickness. It comes after the teachings on using sickness to imaginatively identify with all others, with all life. That is actually indicating a liberation. If we're going to talk, perhaps it's a way of moving towards what the inconceivable liberation, the inconceivable emancipation, the achintya vimoksha is, being liberated into love, into Maitri. The Buddhist tradition says that the citta vimoksha, the liberation of the heart, the liberation of the mind, consists of the Brahma Viharas, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, and Sangharakshita also believes faith and devotion. That if you develop those vast emotional states, those boundless emotions, you are liberated. You are liberated from your state of restriction and separation. You're liberated into love. You're liberated into life, liberated into the life of others. So perhaps that's a way into this inconceivable liberation. Shantideva, the great bodhisattva, in his teachings on meditation, talks especially about the full realization of the sameness of oneself and all others, of the exchange of all others, of the imaginative identification with all others. He says when a bodhisattva develops that protective and loving heart to all that lives, sees everybody as essentially the same as him, then there is removed all sense of, exultation at success, all disappointment at failure. But the bodhisattva just plunges into the deepest suffering that he's going to alleviate, like geese plunging into a lotus lake. Because there's no sense of separation, no sense of being apart. The welfare, his welfare, the welfare of others, the welfare of others and his welfare are exactly the same. There is nothing but leading the liberating life for the benefit of all. So then we have, if we move towards that, a completely new mind, a completely new consciousness, a completely new life, a completely different perspective on every single experience that is presented to us. Mark Kashyapa, at the end of his discourse, says, "What could the entire host of Maras ever do to one who is devoted to this inconceivable liberation?" And Vimalakirti has something to say about that, something to say about the Maras. He tells us what the completely new consciousness of a bodhisattva is in relation to the Maras. And I'm going to end with Vimalakirti's discourse on this. It's really talking about a whole different relationship with difficulties, with challenges. There's so much more we could have gone into in this this exploration of the Vimalakirti Nidesha. I'd like to have talked about Vimalakirti's discourse on the great love, the Mahamaitri. I'd like to have explored the whole meeting, you know, the encounter with the Bodhisattva bringing the perfumed meal from the world of perfumes. I'd like to have talked about the vision of the universe, Abhirati, the pure land of Akshobhya. But listen to Sangharakshita's lectures. Read the sutra. Read the book, The Inconceivable Emancipation. Follow it up. The Vimalakirti Nidesha, although quite a short sutra, Sangharakshita's lectures, although they're quite short, but really they would repay the study of a lifetime. But the last words go to Vimalakirti himself. Then the Lichavi Vimalakirti said to the patriarch Mahakashyapa, "Venerable Mahakashyapa, the Maras who play the devil in the innumerable universes of the ten directions are all bodhisattvas, dwelling in the inconceivable liberation, who are playing the devil in order to develop living beings through their skillful means. Venerable Mahakashyapa, all the miserable beggars who come to the bodhisattvas of the innumerable universes of the 10 directions to ask for a hand, a foot, an ear, a nose, some blood, muscles, bones, marrow, an eye, a torso, a head, a limb, a member, a throne, a kingdom, a country, a wife, a son, a daughter, a slave girl, a horse, an elephant, a chariot, a cart, gold, silver, jewels, pearls, conches, crystal, coral, beryl, treasures, food, drink, elixir and clothes. These demanding beggars are usually bodhisattvas living in the inconceivable liberation, who through their skillful means wish to test and thus demonstrate the firmness of the high resolve of the bodhisattvas. Why, Venerable Mahakashyapa? The bodhisattvas demonstrate that firmness by means of terrible austerities. Ordinary persons have no power to be thus demanding of bodhisattvas unless they are granted the opportunity. They are not capable of killing and depriving in that manner without being freely given the chance. Venerable Mahakashyapa, just as a glowworm cannot eclipse the light of the sun, so, Venerable Mahakashyapa, it is not possible, without special allowance, that an ordinary person can thus attack and deprive a bodhisattva. Venerable Mahakashyapa, just as a donkey could not muster an attack on a wild elephant, even so, Venerable Mahakashyapa, one who is not himself a bodhisattva, cannot harass another bodhisattva. And only a bodhisattva can tolerate the harassment of another bodhisattva. Venerable Mahakashyapa, such is the introduction to the power of the knowledge of skillful means of the bodhisattvas who live in the inconceivable liberation.